Welcome to Creative Conversations. I'm Roger Humphrey. In this episode, I'm pleased to welcome poet, author, novelist, photographer, filmmaker, Alan Governor. We talk about his new movie, Quiet Voices in a Noisy World, The Struggle for Change in Jasper, Texas, his organization, Documentary Arts, and his books. There's over 40 of them that he's published. And we talk about a lot more stuff, too. Hey, before we begin, please hit the like, follow, and subscribe buttons and all of the other buttons you happen to see down there. It's an easy thing to do, and it really, really does help the channel a lot. Also, leave a comment. Let me know what you think. Your opinion is important to me. Thanks. And we are welcoming to this show filmmaker, author, photographer, Alan Governor. Alan, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we've got a lot to talk about. You do just about everything. I started reading about you, and I ran out of breath just reading. Let's start talking about, you've got a new film out called Quiet Voices, The Struggle for Change in Jasper, Texas. I had a chance to watch a little bit of that, and I was struck by number one, just how ordinary Jasper, Texas is. That could be the little town that I live in. It's about the same size, and the same landmarks. You know, Walmart on the corner, blah 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 blah. So, how did you happen to choose Jasper for starters?
First off, the full title of the film is "Quiet Voices in a Noisy World: The Struggle for Change in Jasper, Texas."
Thank you for the correction.
And the film is really the culmination of more than 30 years of work that I've done on and off in Jasper. What brought me to Jasper in 1996 was my interest in a Black community photographer who had passed away, Alonzo Jordan. My wife, artist Kalita Doolin, and I had founded an entity called the Texas African American Photography Archive in 1995, that was built on work I had been doing in the 1980s related to African American music, art, culture. And this archive grew over the years. And we were one of the few independent archives in the country to receive funding from what's called the National Historical Records and Publications Commission.
Wow.
And part of the National Archives. And so we had a full-time archivist working, processing. The collection is more than 60,000 images, prints, and negatives that had not been previously collected and for which there was limited documentation. The last year of our funding from the National Archives focused not only on our collections, but on the collections that were in the libraries of different historically Black colleges in North and East Texas. And through work we were doing in Wiley College with a Black history professor, Lloyd Thompson, I learned about Alonzo Jordan. Lloyd Thompson's wife, Bertha, was from Jasper, and she knew the widow of Alonzo Jordan. And the collection was endangered. Alonzo Jordan was a consummate community person. He was a photographer, but he was a barber. He had his photographic studio. It was a little room off his barbershop. And he was an elder in his church. He was a Sunday school teacher. And he understood the value of photography. And he made photographs largely of schools and other social events, parades, and that affirmed the self-esteem of community life for about 40 years. And he worked in this area with a 70-mile radius of Jasper, these little towns in the area of deep East Texas. And when I saw the condition of the studio, and I met with Mrs. Jordan, and I met with her goddaughter, and we talked about what we were doing with the archive as a public nonprofit endeavor. Mrs. Jordan decided to donate the collection to the archive so that it could be preserved.
Oh, wow.
And that began my relationship with Jasper. And over the years since then, Jasper's gone through some very difficult trauma, most notably the dragging death of James Byrd Jr., the lynching of James Byrd, who was chained to a pickup truck, dragged down a country road, beheaded, dismembered, and dumped in a cemetery. And it was the first time, or one of the first times, that anyone who was white was given the death penalty for killing somebody that was black in Texas.
So this is purely a racially motivated event.
Well, it's yes, and as I delve deeper into this, I realize the extent to which there was this long history of virulent racial violence in this part of Texas. And I organized various exhibitions after 1996, focusing on Jasper and the African American community there. I felt like when the James Byrd incident happened, the national press didn't quite get the full story. And the extent to which the people in Jasper, in the black community especially, it was a very tight-knit, committed, life-affirming group of people. And through my work, and I organized, I think, an exhibition in the late 90s, it would, as part of Photo Fest in Houston, at the Community Arts Collective, which was a African-American run, operated little museum in Houston. And then in 2011, I organized, curated an exhibition on the photographs of Alonzo Jordan. And that became a major exhibition. That there was a book published by the ICP and Steidel in Germany about the book. That year, I received the Guggenheim Fellowship for the work I was doing in Jasper. And when that book was published, it got good notice in the New York Times and other places. But most importantly, it resonated for the African Americans in Jasper and many people who had graduated from the segregated high schools in Jasper and its environs. And I was contacted by a man, George Adams, who's one of the key figures in my movie. And he worked with the Alumni Association, which was spread all over the United States. At that point in time, we were able to identify about 5% of the people in the photographs. And he and his organization acquired 300 copies of the book. And they sent it nationwide, and they identified in the spreadsheet 95% of the people.
Wow, that's a big jump.
And so I continue to follow their efforts. I mean, clearly, I had done, for the ICP exhibition, I had made two video installations in addition to showing this work of Alonzo Jordan. And as I got to know the people in Jasper, I was just so amazed because, as you say, if you were to drive through Jasper, you would think it was any small town in America.
Right.
And I, through the radio work I've done and other, documentary work that I've done, I've traveled all over the United States. And I mean, for example, between 1984 and 1987, I think I traveled around 35,000 miles across Texas.
That's a lot of windshield time.
Well, it was windshield time, both for me and the planes that I took and other modes of transportation. But at that point, I was doing little radio shows on traditional music. But in any case, I was so impressed with what the people in Jasper were doing. And in this group that was called the Lone Star Youth Council. The Lone Star Youth Council was their building was the old Ma Prince Hall Masonic building across the street from where James Byrd Jr. lived. And it was full of Alonzo Jordan photographs.
Wow.
And so that catalyzed my work in Jasper. But this film emerged as a result of what people were doing with the photographs. And the way in which they were on a local level taking control of their own historical legacy. And so George and his group of people who worked at the Lone Star Youth Council, they were putting up roadside markers about Black history. They built three little museums. They built historical markers, all funded through their organization. No public dollars here. And they had some support from this town of Jasper. And slowly, over the time that I've been going back to Jasper, it's been clear that the change that's happening is meaningful in the face of what we're living through now in this culture war, the politics of erasure. So this film couldn't be more timely.
It's where I guess my next question is, where can folks see it? Is it
Well, the film is premiering at Cinema Village, November 14th.
That's in New York.
Cinema Village is a art house theater in New York City near Union Square. And I've premiered other movies there. And they're also presenting a retrospective of 12 other of my movies that I've made over the last 40 years.
Wow.
And the film will be followed by a talk back, but in distribution, so it'll be showing daily for a week in New York City.
Okay.
And then, it's now going to be screening in a theater in Dallas. I mean, much like my other movies, they move into the world in a slow and deliberate way, and they last a long time. My first film that premiered in New York in 1981 is still in distribution today.
Oh, wow. So,
And my first published book was released in a 40-year anniversary edition a couple of years ago.
oh, congratulations
So
on that.
I'm in it for the long term. And I'm just going to keep doing it. So, but the distributor for the film is First Run Features in New York. But like my other films, though, this one will likely be on Amazon Prime in the coming year.
Oh,
And
okay.
so I have more than two dozen films on Amazon Prime.
Oh.
And you can, and I've published over 40 books, and just about every one of them is available through Amazon and other booksellers.
Think that it's kind of an interesting time that we live in because distribution is, I don't want to say better, but certainly different. I think there are better opportunities at times. But there's also there's a lot of noise out there too. There's a lot of people trying to do that kind of work. But
Well,
it's
it.
go ahead.
No, go ahead. You finish what you're saying.
Well,
I'm sorry.
so I guess I was wondering how it's changed for you in that regard over the last 40 or 50 years that you've been doing this.
Well, it's changed, but in many ways, it's been a continuous stream. I started my first book when I was 18. I
Wow.
started writing poetry when I was 17. I still write poetry
Okay.
every day or work on poetry.
Yeah.
Poetry is an organic process. So for me, I've been persistent I've been fortunate, I've been blessed to be able to have the life that I've had, but it hasn't been easy. And there are different kinds of difficulties at every stage. And I have tended to focus on areas of art, culture, life that are often marginalized, neglected. I have a style of writing. I think of my nonfiction books as being literary, but I have published now two novels. I've published different collections of poems over the years as artist books. I've written plays. And so I enjoy words and I enjoy creative expression, but I'm also a photographer. And so for me, I respond to the world differently. The subject at hand defines the medium. And I've always had multiple interests. I mean, for me, a visual metaphor of the way I approach the world is in part kind of depicted in the painting by Duchamp, The New Descending Staircase.
Okay.
It's cubist. It's based in a way off a Meyerbridge photograph of someone walking down a flight of stairs, but it's all about seeing reality for all its different facets.
When you do it, you have a photographer's eye. So when you are doing a film, how much of the videography do you do yourself, or do you have a videographer and you just kind of direct that person, or how does that work?
Well, I am a self-taught filmmaker, and so I have benefited greatly from others. And my first film was shot by Les Blank, who became my mentor. And Les Blank was a filmmaker whose documentaries I truly admired, and I was pleased that he wanted to work on my film. And as that moved forward, I mean, Les really enjoyed working on it, and he helped bring my film to a bigger audience. When my film premiered at Film Forum in 1981, it was with two of his films. And really, to even call Stony Nose House simply my film is not really accurate, because I had Les Blank as a collaborator, I had Pacho Lane as a collaborator, and it was very difficult making that film. I went through a lot of obstacles. It was that, I had gotten my first NEA grant in 1978, 79. And at that time, I was teaching at an art college in Columbus, Ohio. And I needed a fiscal agent to receive the grant to be able to apply. And the college I was working for agreed to become that fiscal agent on the condition that they would never receive a credit in the final film. And before I got to Les Blank, I had gone through various other film crews. It was difficult because my first book and film were on a man who was hunchbacked in a wheelchair, had been disabled by rheumatoid arthritis as a child, stunted his growth. And he was denied an education for being too grotesque to go to school.
Ooh.
And it's one of the only documents of the inside life of a person who was a performer, an actor on the outside, outdoor stage of the sideshow.
So, well, you've done also, you talk about marginalized people, and you've done two books on tattoo artists. Is that right?
Well, I've done more. I mean, that was my first book, was Stony Knows How: Life as a Tattoo Artist. And then when I got the idea to make the movie, I invited Ed Hardy from San Francisco, who was at the height of his career. And he came to Columbus, and Ed was someone who had a fine arts background. He was revolutionizing tattooing by introducing an artistry that had unparalleled in the medium. And Ed appreciated my work, and a lot of younger tattoo artists did, because my books are in the tattoo world are, considered foundational in some ways to the transformation of the public perception of tattooing. And my work chronicles how what may have been the most forbidden art form in the Western world has become one of the most common. And so I've done other books on tattoo that I did with Ed Hardy. It was many. We did an exhibition together at the Hertzberg Museum in San Antonio. It became a big show at the Drawing Center in New York City. Ed Hardy had a publishing company. He published a magazine. And then I've done other books on tattoo. I did two books about Ed Hardy. One is called Art for Life, and there were collaborations with him, and the other is called Beyond Skin. And I worked on the texts of these books. It was his, of course, visual imagery. And most currently, there's a trilogy of books that have come out in the last year and is still coming out on Gus Wagner. And this is a tattoo collection of maritime seamen. And the
Oh.
first book is about Gus Wagner, the second's about his wife, the third is about his daughter. So my work on tattooing, while it's not something I do every single day, is a very important part, because becoming engaged with the subjects, I feel a sense of commitment. And so it results in different kinds of media, from poetry to stories to novels. My novel, Come Round Right,
Yes.
which started when I was 18, was finally published 52 years later.
Wow. And that is about what is the subject matter of
That
that?
is based on true events in my life.
Oh.
And it's a book about, it's a paean to the end of the 1960s.
Okay.
It's about hitchhiking.
Oh.
And it's set in the fictional past of 1970 and the fictional present of 1971. And it's a series of rides across America and into Canada.
How fascinating. How fascinating.
And its past and present ultimately converge. But it's a book about what does one do to survive trauma. And so that's another theme in my work. And that book is based on trauma that I've lived through.
So this would be
When I
personal
say,
trauma, but you also do like cultural trauma, like in Jasper, Texas.
exactly. So that's, similarly, you think about Stoney. I mean, Stoney was obviously physically immensely challenged,
Sure.
and he dealt with the trauma of not being denied an education because of his physical appearance. And I think that my work is very much connected. It may seem in a way disparate because I work in a lot of different media, but it's all very connected for me. There are different threads. It's a forest. It's a
So,
garden.
yeah, you've worked. You said you had a radio show when you were doing folk music. Am I remembering that correctly?
Well, I did, these were short little radio features. They
Oh.
were, where I would, talk to different people around the country, maybe for an hour and a half. And or sometimes I spend a day with them. And usually, if I spent a day, it's like I have a book that's called Extraordinary Ordinary People, Five Masters of Traditional Arts. And it's people I spent a day or a couple of days with. And so they became films. They became, my work with them, but essentially, as radio, they were 5-minute radio features. They're completely evergreen, so that they and they were the first ones I did were in Texas. I traveled 35,000 miles around Texas, recording these on front porches, backyards.
Sure.
I'd meet people on the side of the road. I'd find out about singers, and it all fit into different kinds of creative activity. I mean,
So
from it, the radio work I did impacted what I do in musical theater, but those regional shows in 1991, 92, I did pr produce and recorded a 52-part series called Masters of Traditional Music, and it was about the cultures of their world as they're found in the United States. And then I did another series in 2010 that was also 52 parts, called Masters of Traditional Arts. And all these radio shows are available online on
Oh.
my on documentary arts website, mastersoftraditionalarts.org. This was a 35-year documentary project. And so there's a lot there. It's an encyclopedia, and it focuses on individuals who receive.
I'll have a link down there in the description so people can find it easily.
Yeah, it's something people ought to check out. There's all kinds of educational materials and the like. So, and
It
once again,
sort of mirrors to some extent, and it's sort of emphasis on sort of the work that John and Alan Lomax did in the 30s and the 40s with.
well, yes, and in some ways it does, but theirs was more music, and
Right.
it was different. I mean,
Yes.
in fact, my new movie, the soundtrack is largely recordings that I found that John Lomax did in East Texas
Oh.
in 1940. In
Okay.
fact, he recorded two people in Jasper.
Was that
Yeah, you're gonna have to watch the rest of the movie.
right? Absolutely. So, now documentary arts. Now, this is an organization that you started some years ago, correct? Can we touch on that real quick, Mike?
Documentary arts, I founded in 1985,
Okay.
and with the mission to broaden public knowledge and appreciation of the arts of different cultures in all media. Over the years, documentary arts has created new perspectives on historical issues and diverse cultures. And this has led to working in a lot of different media,
Now this
from
is this the,
analog radio to interactive media.
so
So,
and this is a regular nonprofit, registered nonprofit as I
it
recall.
is. However, I have never served as a full-time executive director.
Oh.
I've never been a salaried director. Everything that documentary arts does is project driven.
Oh, okay.
So it's a loosely connected network of like-minded people that's become more global over the years. And so we have many websites, and we publish an online magazine called truthinphotography.org, which you should definitely share with your listeners.
Down there, yeah.
And that's published between 2 and 4 times a year, but
Okay.
it examines issues related to truth and image making, so that there is a lot of different facets to documentary arts. I never really wanted to be a full-time executive director. In some respects, it was inspired, I suppose, by the Farm Security Administration. And in another level, it was inspired by Magnum Photos. And I'm a collaborator in terms of part of what I make and do. But I've always understood and created a balance between my public work that I do through documentary arts and my private work, which is my inner life. that writes poems every day.
And I can't let you go until we talk about Stompin' at the Savoy.
Stompin' at the Savoy is, you know, once again, a very documentary arts project that has many facets. Stompin' at the Savoy is based on a children's book of mine called Stompin' at the Savoy, The Story of Norma Miller. I met Norma Miller when I was working on a musical with Akin Babatunde called Blind Lemon Blues.
Would that
And
be
it's
on
early bird
Blind
in.
Lemon Jefferson? Is that the reference?
Yes, yes. It was actually the first iteration of this when I met Norma around 2000. It was Blind Lemon, Prince of Country Blues, that became Blind Lemon Blues, which was a tighter ensemble cast, which had two full productions off Broadway, toured to about 14 cities in Europe, and was distilled into a one-person musical called Lonesome Blues. I met Norma through Frankie Manning, who, and Frankie was one of the great innovators in the development of the Lindy Hop swing dance. And I was looking for someone to help us with what were the dances associated with Blind Lemon Jefferson and his music, because I've been writing about Blind Lemon in books that I've and articles that I'd written about blues and Texas blues. And at that time, Norma was choreographing floor shows in Las Vegas. And she came to Dallas, worked with my local cast, and it was wonderful. I mean, she was a fountain of information. And she was by then probably close to 80, I would think. Yeah, I think she was about 80 years old, because she died, I think, in 2019, and she was 99 years old. And we knew each other for a lot of years. While she was in Dallas, you know, working with the Dallas-based cast, she was in my office and told me this wonderful story about her as a child growing up in Harlem, and that in summer nights, she'd sit on the fire escape and she'd watch the silhouettes of the dancers in the Savoy. And she'd go back inside and do them for her mother and sister. And by the time she was a teenager, she was busking on the streets. And one Easter Sunday, the premier dancer of the day, Twist Mouth George, came out of the Savoy ballroom and saw her busking and said, "Hey, kid, you want to dance with me?" And that was the propelled her into an amazing career. And she was an acrobatic swing dancer. She was a great raconteur. And so this musical is based on the children's book that I did with her. And then the musical has a book, a musical book that was written by myself and Fader Michelle Scott. And I created this. And it had its world premiere production in at the Delaware Theater Company in April, May of this year. And it's coming to New York, you know, I think in early 27.
That sounds terrific. And one other thing, real quick, like you also have a photo exhibit in at Woodstock right now at the Photography Center there.
There's two exhibitions that have been organized by the Center for Photography at Woodstock, focusing on the work of documentary arts over the last 4 decades. There's a large exhibition that's called Everyday Culture, Seven Projects of Documentary Arts. And then there is another exhibition that's called Kinship and Community, which focuses on the Texas African American Photography Archive. That exhibition is curated by Nicole Fleetwood, and the Everyday Culture exhibition is curated by Brian Wallace, with whom I co-authored a book about my work over the years. There's also a book that's going to be published later this year, be in the beginning of 2026, by Aperture, called Kinship and Community, selections from the Texas African American Photography Archive. So it's a very productive time for me. I didn't really ever, I think that at this age I would be as creatively active as I am.
Well, I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, holy mackerel. I mean, this guy's got a film coming out, books coming out, photos, exhibitions. I mean, are you tap dancing on the side?
No, actually, I have a very good life in terms of what I do every day. I listen to the same piece of music driving to my office every day. I walk 4 to 6 miles every day.
Wow.
And I listen to the same music going home every day. So within that day, it's my thinking and creativity goes a lot of different places. But the other part of it, and what's very important to me, is I've been married now for going on 37 years, and my wife is an artist, and we work in different spaces. And this, we have like a little campus of buildings that she acquired that where we work. So all these activities can flourish because she also works in different media. But we have lunch every day in one building, and then we have coffee in another building in the afternoon. So it's a wonderful routine. And now our son and his wife have moved to Texas, and we have they have two little children. So I have two grandkids here. I have two grandkids in the Philadelphia area that are the children of my daughter. So it's an access. Everything as best as possible is kept in balance. It's not always easy, but having the regularity of that. But my wife and I, because we work in the arts, divide our time between here and New York City. I mean, we've had a footprint in New York for over 25 years.
Wow.
And so it's a different routine there, but I still do my basic routine of walking daily. Walking is really important to me. And it's a way to sort of put my life in perspective, what I'm going to do. But also, I'm a napper. So I take short naps during the day too.
Me too.
And
yeah.
Well, I think they're really important. And so having worked for myself, virtually my entire adult life, I mean, I have a doctorate in arts and humanities and had thought I was going to become a university professor, which I did part-time teaching and the like. But largely, I've had a career of my own making.
That's absolutely terrific. So, well, Alan, thank you so much. Believe it or not, we're about out of time. So I'm going to say thank you for taking the time with us. I really, really appreciate this. There's a lot more I want to talk to you about. Time just doesn't allow, so perhaps we can get together again in a few months when one or two or 12 of your other projects come up, and we'll spend a little time together there as well. So, but thank you.
Thank you.
Good meeting you.
Likewise. Bye-bye.
I'd like to thank Alan for taking the time to come on the show. If you would like to know more about him, you can find a link to his website in the descriptions down below. I'd like to thank you too for taking the time to listen. If you enjoy these podcasts, please share your favorite episodes with your friends and introduce them to Creative Conversations with Roger Humphrey.